So, first of all, do you have questions about last lecture? Everything was crystal clear. I have some doubts, but I pretend I believe you. Yes?
I'm not very sure, but maybe you mentioned that the stress energy tensor is zero.
Right, that's what I'm going to discuss precisely that now. This is a purely classical statement. So we are trying to study this action, which is a function of the metric, of the 2D metric, and of some positions. Right. And the equations of motion that come from this metric are that delta S over delta H AB is 0, and delta S over delta X mu is 0. Now, this thing is, by definition, called the stress tensor. So if you have any quantum field theory that can be coupled to a metric, the variation of the action, every classical field theory, really, that it can be coupled to a metric, the variation of the action respect to the metric is called the stress tensor.
So the action does not depend on derivatives of the metric?
It is a functional derivative. So it can totally depend on derivatives of the metric. You just take a functional derivative. So what functional derivative means, right? So the statement is that if you take the action and you evaluate on HAB plus delta HAB and X, this equals to the action without the fluctuation plus the integral over whatever is your little space-time, which is 2D here, possibly the square root of H delta H AB DAB. That's how you define the functional derivative. The functional derivative is some local thing which integrated over the whole space gives you the variation. Why do we call this quantity the stress tensor, when it went to a tensor? For example, suppose that my theory is invariant under diffeomorphisms. So that here I've got is a function of the metric, but really want this to only depend on the metric and the fields modulo changes of coordinates. Whenever we couple something to a metric, we don't really mean couple it to a matrix of things, but it's couple it in a way that is invariant under diffeomorphisms. Now, under diffeomorphism, the metric changes. This way. Pretty much by definition. Which means that this change should vanish if my theory is independent under invariant under diffeomorphisms, then this should vanish when the variation of H takes this form. So you get a relation like del square U square root of H del A V B T A B equal to 0 for every V, which then implies something like that the T is conserved. I'm wondering, perhaps I should not have put the H here, square root of H here. I always forget. Do you remember? Somebody remember from general relativity
We used to put the square root of two on the stress tensor was the other.
Okay. Yeah, it's probably some feature of integration by parts that works well like that, anyway. Okay, so this is the reason we identified this as a stress tensor. So it's conserved. It's a conserved quantity. In particular, in flat space, you can use it to get conservation of energy, momentum, and so on. Now, so this came from the diffeomorphism invariants. Now, suppose that your action is also invariant under wild transformations. Which is just a rescaling of the metric.
Quick question about wild transformation. Does it have to be smooth, like local scaling? Does it have to be smooth across the manifold?
Not necessarily. I mean, I guess you, like for coordinate systems, I guess you could shape. Decide to pick a coordinate system here and a different coordinate system here. But anyway, potentials of smoothness anyway would only matter in classical physics, and then it's about, you know, whatever are your conditions of smoothness on your fields. So this one will give you that for a wild invariant theory, classically, the stress tensor is traceless. And these statements are if and only if. If your stress tensor is conserved, then you have invariance under diffeomorphisms. If it's traceless, you have invariance under wild transformations. Now, right, these are classical statements. Quantum mechanics, clearly, they will still hold at the operator level, meaning that now we're talking about some correlation functions. In the presence of some metric. And you try to write it as the correlation functions with the original metric plus correlation functions with the insertion of an extra stress tensor, roughly. And you still get these equations to hold at operator level.
Wait, sorry, what's that idea? Is that delta NJP as a function of U?
Yes, yes. So whatever was. Yes. Sorry, the eraser is really a paintbrush here. So, very nice. Now, it's often the case that a symmetry can hold classically, but not quantum mechanically. Notice that when I write a statement like this, for example, this correlation function will be computed perhaps by path integral optimistically. And when I change my metric, both the action in the path integral and the measure might change. So this t that appears here might be subtly different from what the t that you have classically. Anyway, this t typically is a polynomial of the fields. So to define it as a quantum operator, you will have anyway to renormalize it, which implicitly also means they're incorporating the effects of the measure. Anyway, the point is that in your it's perfectly possible that a relation like this holds classically but not quantum mechanically. And if it fails to hold quantum mechanically, then the symmetry is pretty much gone. So in general, it might be the case that classically or quantum mechanically, your trace might be non-zero. And if it's non-zero, you can imagine writing it as a sum of some coefficients times some basis of local operators, of scalar local operators in your theory. These coefficients are called beta functions.
Yes.
Usually you encounter beta functions in the Kalman-Szymanski equations, for example, which precisely tell you how the correlation functions change under a rescale, a scale transformation, which means that this was your eta mu nu, eta ab, and you just shift it by amount proportional to eta ab. And so you get the insertion of some operator times the constant, but there's a change in the coupling. So if I were to replace, right, so let me just write it. So suppose that this was just delta phi HAB, right? Then this would be delta phi, and then here I would have this HAB TAB. I could rewrite it as some sum of CI OI. These are the operators, which means I'm changing the couplings by these amounts. So I could rewrite this as sort of, so if delta phi is a constant and the metric is a constant, I could just rewrite this as a sum of CI del over del GI of the correlation function, assuming that I have some action where my couplings multiply these operators. So in quantum field theory classes, typically you compute some scattering amplitudes or something, and you ask how it changes when you change the scale, and you start learning about beta functions like that. But what the beta functions are simply this. The beta functions are, in whatever scheme you're using, the coefficients of the trace of the stress tensor. You write this.
And this, like in quantum field theory, when we computed a beta function, we did it like in the weakly coupled limit, and we computed like the first order.
Yes, in perturbation theories, yes.
But this is, all of this is perturbation theory.
No, these are just universal statements. So, notice that in order to make a statement like this, you need to be able to talk about the possible local operators. And there is no canonical way to define, to identify local operators. And there are always, there is a space of local operators, but, and when we do two different people do calculations in the quantum field theory, they will end up with the same space, but they will not necessarily have the same basis of operators in that space. So these beta functions are only as well defined as your choice of basis is. In perturbation theory, these ambiguities on the choice of basis are called schemes. And so beta functions will have a certain amount of scheme dependence. And when you compute beta functions, sometimes you compute something which is a physical meaning, sometimes you're computing something which is just a convention of what you're doing. So But anyway, we can discuss this at length, but perhaps in the office hours with a better time. It's a fun topic. And it's explained so poorly in quantum field theory textbooks. I mean, or it's relegated in some, you know, renormalization chapter, which is like treated as it's an annoyance you need to get through in order to get to the real stuff. But it's really the real stuff. You know, computing a specific scattering amplitude, whatever. It's important for measurements or for experiments, but it's not what's teaching you about what quantum field theory looks like.
And what's the connection between this beta function and the stuff we were doing yesterday, like where this comes about from?
Right. So if you have beta functions which are non-zero, you would typically say the theory is not while invariant. And I cannot, in particular, I cannot sort of treat while symmetry as a gauge symmetry because there is no while symmetry. Now, there is a interesting point, though. Which is, there is a very mild way you could be breaking while invariance, which is this, that on the right-hand side, you only have a multiple of the identity. This is very mild because that means that if you do a change, a while transformation, your correlation functions will change, but they'll change by an overall scale. And typically, when you study correlation functions, we just divide by the expectation the vacuum expectation value and get rid of the overall scale anyway. So you will mostly not notice this. So when you set, when you're a situation like this, where a symmetry is broken, but is only broken by an overall scale of the correlation functions, you call this an anomaly, an anomalous symmetry. When you have an anomalous symmetry, most of the consequences of having a symmetry are still there. But you still cannot gauge it. Because you still get some inconsistencies if the overall scale of things is not well defined. So in the case we're studying here, and in a lot of other situations, so where the theory was essentially free once you went to the flat metric. This is the only problem that can occur. So you can get what's called a central charge, and sort of an anomaly in this in the wild symmetry. And this will receive contributions from the various fields in your theory. So you can compute it in the case of this action and this path integral with some work. And you find that this equals the number of dimensions of space-time minus 26. And that was the reason to say that you can only define this bosonic string theory in 26 space-time dimensions.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean by the consequences of the symmetry are still there?
Well, for example, if you literally what I said, that if you take correlation functions and you divide by the vacuum expectation value, they'll be invariant under the symmetry.
But yes? I thought the anomaly is awkward when we cannot find some part of the preserve the sequence symmetry. Because in KFT, we have to introduce some cutoff to compute something, and if we cannot find some, we cutoff cannot preserve this symmetry.
So anomalies are an obstruction to gauging symmetries. So, for example, in the standard model, we have an SU3 and SU2 gauge fields, and also U1 gauge field. Right. These act on a bunch of other fields, including some chiral fermions. These fermions, they, you know, you can put them in the Lagrangian with these gauge fields because they have some globals, some U1, SU2, and SU3 global symmetries that you couple to the gauge fields to make them into gauge symmetries. These chiral fermions are perfectly good theories by themselves before you couple them to the gauge fields. And yes, these global symmetries, but these global symmetries potentially have anomalies. And so if you take just a random collection of chiral fermions, you cannot gauge all of their symmetries. The fermions that appear in the standard model come in very specific families for which these anomalies cancel. So the anomalies are obstructions to gauging the symmetries. But if you just think about the global symmetry, well, it could be a fact that there is a global symmetry, which is an anomalous global symmetry. And you can still get all of those useful consequences from them, you just cannot gauge it.
Why is there only one number for the central charge? Like, why is the only possibility C1?
Well, if you have something which is not one, then it would really change your correlation functions, not just change them up to a scale. Not just leave them invariant up to a scale. And so we typically would not call it a symmetry. It has almost no useful consequences. Nothing changes, you know, everything changes after it, under it, so it's not a symmetry. But if you have something like this, where there is only that entity, it's, you know, it's still very useful.
And
where
does the 26 come
from? And so I'll get there in a second. Another thing I want to say, sorry, before I continue, is that now suppose I have two theories, theory one and theory two. And so I can combine them. I can have a new theory, which has just the fields of this theory and the fields of this theory, not talking to each other at all. It's called stacking in condensed matter physics, because you really just get some material, and you stack another material on top of it, and now it's a more complicated material. Theories can be multiplied. There's also a way to add theories, but that will confuse you a lot, so I will not discuss it. The stress tensor of the combined theory is the sum of the stress tensors of the two individual theories. And also the trace of the stress tensor is the sum of the two traces. Sorry, my indices were in the wrong place. Now, if this was just an operator in the first theory, I will never be able to cancel it against an operator of the second theory. So if I have a theory which is not well invariant, and I combine it with another theory that is not well invariant, the combination would not be well invariant. But if this is just a multiple of that entity, I can totally cancel it against a multiple of another identity. So the reason we like to think about anomalous symmetries as symmetries is also that when I combine theories with the same symmetry, I get a new theory with the same symmetry. The anomalies just add up. And if I add them add up to zero, I can actually engage the symmetry. So like leptons and quarks have their own anomalies. You couldn't gauge SU2 if you just had leptons or quarks. But if you have leptons and quarks, you can gauge SU2. So here, this D is the sum of several terms. Because, OK, here, the X's and H's are all combined together. So I cannot just add things up. But if I gauge fix, HAB to eta to delta AB, then I will just get, my action is going to be just the sum over mu of del x mu over del ua del x mu over del ua. So it's literally the sum of one separate term for each dimension. So naively, I will just get a contribution from each dimension. And this is the D here. The subtle is that when I do this gauge fixing, there is a Fatih Popov determinant that enters the measure. I can rewrite it as a, in terms of some ghosts. And so I get a contribution from the ghosts to the anomaly. And that's the minus 26. So this is d times what's essentially a scalar. And this is the ghosts. Or the Fatih Popov.
Why do they contribute with negative signs? Why do the ghost fields contribute with negative signs?
Well, it's a theorem that the contribution of a unitary theory is positive. So this can be contribute something negative only because they're ghosts, which are not unitary. Why it's minus 26? It's a calculation. You really need to write down the theory of the ghosts, write down the stress tensor, normal order it properly, and look what the traces. What the traces. And it's in the notes, and we might get over it. But it's a calculation. Okay.
Could we have an anomaly for the different of Pisano's part? Because in GR, we said that conservation is not like a real conservation law, but like a consistency condition, I think, related with Einstein equations.
So this is a, I was, so this is a true statement. If you want to get a conservation law out of it, you need the actual symmetry of the matrix, like Killing vector. And then you would get integral of xt commutative with the Killing vector on some surface, being independent of the surface. But that's separate from having a quantum mechanical breaking of the symmetry or an anomaly. So you could ask, is it possible for diffeomorphism invariants to be anomalous? It's a reasonable question. The reason you typically say no, in a theory where the metric is not dynamical, at least, which anyway has to be the case for a field theory, is that when you regularize your path integral, you typically want to impose some cutoff on distances or on frequencies or whatnot. And you can formulate this cutoff in a way that uses the metric and is diffeomorphism invariant. Like, you can measure the distances with a metric. That's a diffeomorphism invariant way to measure distances. So it's typically expected that diffeomorphisms can be preserved by quantization. Now recall, quantization is not a canonical procedure. So this statement just means you can quantize, you can find ways to quantize in such a way that diffeomorphisms are preserved. That's the expectation. On the other hand, wild transformations really change distances. And so they change cutoffs. And so there is at least the potential for regularization to break wild symmetry. And being able to preserve it up to an overall C number is actually miraculous. Meaning that your typical quantum field theory, even if it's conformal invariance when you write it down classically is not going to be conformal invariant quantum mechanically. Here we're going to look at a very special quantum field theory, which is free. That helps. Renormalizations of free theories is very simple. You don't renormalize the action. The only thing that gets renormalized is the operators themselves, and only very mildly, because you need to normal order them. And it's just normal ordering subtleties in the definition of the stress tensor, which will make this number appear. If your theory is interacting, then, well, you get beta functions, typically. So the existence of conformal field theories is special. The fact that they actually exist is quite non-trivial. And so perhaps surprisingly, there are a lot of conformal field theories in two dimensions. Even continuous families of conformal field theories. And as we will perhaps manage to see towards the end of the talk, this is really intimately connected with the existence of string theory, at least perturbative three-level string theory, classical string theory. So classical string theory pretty much explores the space of Wahl invariant two-dimensional quantum field theories. It's like the space of classical solutions to string theory is the same as the space of two-dimensional conformal field theories with a certain central charge. And beta functions are pretty much the equations of motion of string theory. But we'll get there. So now I wanted to shift gear from these very general considerations to something very concrete, which is understanding this action. Oops. So we understood how to get from the string theory quantization to a two-dimensional problem, right? As you remember, the output of the last lecture was a statement that we'll do string theory calculations as integrals over some spaces of complex structures. Of a path integral over the axis on some with this action. And so we leave this for the end. Now we focus on this part of the calculation. Okay, so let me write the action again. I will forget for sure the correct normalization. Remember there was this tension, which was a dimensional quantity put in front of everything. Because it's dimensionful, I just set it to 1. So all the momenta and lengths and whatever in space-time will be measured in units of this scale. So the action for my scalar fields for a single coordinate, use a capital X to give it importance, is 1/2 integral of dx over du a dx over du a the square u. Okay, so, and I want to describe situations where my strings look like cylinders moving through space-time. Locally. And so I have these two u coordinates. And I'll call one of them tau, the one that goes along the cylinder, and the other one sigma. And sigma is periodic. You could tell me, okay, this is a Wahl invariant theory. Why do we care about the size of the cylinder. And indeed, this L will drop out at the end of the calculations. But in the in intermediate steps, it's going to teach us a few interesting things. So I'll keep it there for now. OK, so how do you quantize this system? You must have done scalars in your. Have you done scalar fields at some point? I assume, right? So quantize the scalar field. What do you do? However you want. I'm open to any quantization scheme. We can do that. But I want to find the Hilbert space, essentially. That's where I'm aiming. That's what I want. Sorry, I should be more specific. Yeah, perfectly correct. The path integral would be a great way to compute correlation functions. Absolutely. But suppose I want to find the Hilbert space. How do I find the Hilbert space for this system?
Mm-hmm. Can I turn it into Fourier modes?
Sure, why not? Right. I'll have some zero mode. And then some Fourier mode, some non-zero modes. Okay, very good. And then how do I proceed?
Maybe introduce
Gronsky. So each of these modes is now what system?
Harmonic
oscillator. Yes, exactly. Exactly. So I'm going to get some creation. I mean, this would be an harmonic oscillator with frequency n over L. And this would be just something with an x dot squared action. So it's going to be essentially a free particle. And so the Hilbert space is going to look like, well, the Hilbert space of a free particle, you know, L2R. So we'll have some wave function, you know, I'll have some states which are labeled perhaps by momentum, right? And then, a harmonic oscillator, Hilbert space, so Fock space. So a Fock space. And I have some creation and annihilation operators. Now, I'm going to use notations which are perhaps slightly unusual to what you would normally use. So I will give some somewhat strange names to the creation and annihilation operators with positive and negative frequency. So I have some a n and a minus n and some. So I have some a n's. Sorry, let me just write something here. So. Let me just write this in terms of the various modes. I'm going to write the classical solution, sort of. So, Okay. So I'm going to use different symbols for things that depend holomorphically on sigma plus I tau, and things that depend anti-holomorphically on sigma plus I, sigma minus I tau. The reason is that, as we saw last time, complex coordinates are really useful when you study conformal field theories, theories of dual symmetry. For example, the equations of motion can just be written as del del bar x equal to 0, which means classical solutions are some functions of z, or sort of holomorphic coordinates, sigma plus I tau, plus some other function of anti-holomorphic coordinates. Because that's the most general solution of del del bar equal to 0. Del del bar equal to 0 is solved by taking something that's killed by del bar and something that's killed by del, and adding them up. And so it's nice to separate out notationally things which are holomorphic and things which are anti-holomorphic. Mm-hmm.
Is there an analogy between holomorphic, anti-holomorphic, and left and right movers?
Like, yes, absolutely. So here I'm working with Euclidean signature on the worksheet. If I were to go to a Lorentz signature on the worksheet, I would go from tau to it, or minus it, I forget. But yeah, so this would become a function of sigma plus tau, and this is a function of sigma minus tau, which means they will move left or right. That's correct. And we could have a very long discussion of about should I use Euclidean or Lorentzian signature on the worksheet, which you can play that game already for particles. You could ask yourself, okay, when I write down the first order, no, the Feynman parametrization or Zwinger time parametrization, or I write the propagator as integral of e to the minus l p squared, or should I do e to the I l p squared? What's the right way to do it? I epsilon prescriptions, blah, blah, blah. So the point is that ultimately it doesn't really matter. All sort of path integrals are secretly contour path integrals. And there are a whole bunch of calculations which do not depend on the contour. And there are things that depend on the contour, but you can contour the form. So when there is a beautiful paper by Witten that discusses this, but pretty much the point is that when the dust settles, all of these subtleties about which metric one I want to use end up on this finite dimensional integral over complex structures. And there I can do whatever contour deformations I want. So pretty much we're gonna work with Euclidean signature. We're gonna get some nice integrals at the very end, which when we get these integrals over the complex structures. And sometimes we'll have to deform these integration contours or do things that keep track of the I epsilon prescription. But that's it. It's convenient and useful to use Euclidean coordinates on the worksheet. And if you were to redo everything in Lorentzian signature, you would get to the same place at the end.
Where the second term comes from, the IP term?
Well, this is just the free particle. The classical solution for a free particle is that I have some position plus some.
Why there is imaginary?
Because in Lorentzian, this would be a T.
Okay.
So this is something to be very aware when you study quantum field theory, that your notions about reality conditions on fields are set in Lorentzian signature, where unitarity is meaningful. When you go to Euclidean signature, a lot of reality conditions start looking weird. This is particularly true when you look at fermions. So if you try to ask yourself questions like, is this a real or a complex Grassmann field in Euclidean signature, you get confused for weeks. And the answer is simply that the related condition is set in Lorentzian signature. Okay. Yes. So once I write, introduce these coefficients, the commutation relations look like this. And looking at these commutation relations, or just looking at which modes have positive energy here, we find that operators that create things are the ones with negative. Indices, and then with positive indices, destroy things. Okay, so that's why I was saying that this notation might look a little unfamiliar. Usually, you see things like you denote maybe the creation operator, the creation operators, the extraction operators with something without bars. And the creation with bars, so things like that. Here, the bar refers only to the classical solution being holomorphic or anti-holomorphic. It doesn't refer to Hermitian conjugation. So the Hermitian conjugate of A is not A bar. The Hermitian conjugate of A minus N is An. And the Hermitian conjugate of A bar minus N is A bar N. So it's just a convention.
Mm-hmm. Do the bar and unbarred operators commute?
Yes, 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 yes. So everything else is zero. So it's just a notation, but and it's convenient for doing conformal theory.
Mm-hmm. Why do we know that A n bar is like the bar or A of A n and not different
Bn? So you would go in Lorentzian signature first, which means that these I's are not here. And then you take Hermitian conjugation, and you see that it switches the sign of n and does not mix A and A bars. So these are left movers, these are right movers. They just do their own thing. They are not really related in any way. So this is a point of notation which can be confusing at first when you read it. But you just need to remember this is not content, this is just notation. So just that you might have expectations of what the notations would be. And those can create confusion. Okay, so now we know what the Hilbert space is going to look like. The Hilbert space is built out of a basis of states for the zero modes, which are going to be delta function normalizable. And then you act on it by the creation operators. Get the gist. It's a Fock space created from these infinitely many oscillators.
Mm-hmm. Are we thinking of the zero mode part of the Hilbert space as the space of vacuum?
The word vacuum is really, really loaded. So you need to be cautious with it. If you think ground state, these are the ground states for the oscillator modes, but they have energy p squared. We'll see it in a moment. Right. So I don't know if I would call them vacua. I mean, their ground state, they come from the vacuum or the Fock space tensor with a generic state for the zero mode.
What does a generic state look like in that space?
Well, one is an eigenvalue of momentum. Another could be eigenvalue of position. Or it could be any crazy wave function I want in the 2R, any H2 normalizable wave function. It's up to you to pick a basis. The momentum basis is helpful because the energy is simple in the momentum basis. So indeed, now to understand this Hilbert space a bit better, we can ask what's the energy and what's the momentum of the states on the worksheet. Yeah, let's be careful here. So this P refers to the, I call it P because it behaves like a momentum in space-time. This is the center of mass of the string. The center of mass of the string is moving through space-time in some way with the momentum P. Now, I could separately ask, what's energy and momentum of this two-dimensional scalar field theory? Right, where this energy momentum means the integral of t 0, 0 or the integral of t 0, 1 on space. This will be important when I try to impose the constraint that the t vanishes.
Is p the momentum of the entire string, or the momentum like averaged over the string?
Is the center of mass momentum. So it's an average.
And it's the center of mass position.
Yes, that's right. Right. Okay, but for now, let's just familiarize ourselves a little bit with this Hilbert space. I think that's all we have time for. So, how do you calculate this Hilbert space? For example, okay, let me just define some normalization of the, or let me forget about the zero modes for a bit. How do I compute something like this? The inner product between, say, a minus 1, the norm of some. Okay. How do I compute something like that? So I took this vector in the Hilbert space. I want to contract it with the Hermitian conjugate. How would I compute this answer?
Can you use commutations?
Yes, that's correct. So you say A1, A minus 1 equals 1 plus A minus 1, A1. And use the fact that A1 annihilates the ground state for the harmonic oscillator. And so this becomes equal to P prime plus P A minus 1, A1, P prime, which is 0. And you can do it in the same way to compute the norm of any of these states or inner product of any of these states. And most of them are going to be 0. Like, for example, you know, if I can try to do something like this. This will vanish because this can be commuted across this, and it will kill that. So pretty much this is an orthogonal basis with norms which are easily computed. Like, I mean, you can do a more complicated example, P A1 squared, A minus 1 squared, P prime. Right now I need to commute these across two of these to have it annihilate that. So I get a factor of two. And then I have one more of these, and then I commute across the remaining one, and I get a factor of one. So perhaps try to convince yourself that this equals to twice P prime.
Wait, sorry, what does that say underneath the delta function, right? We've got phi a to a, what's the subscript on the second?
Sorry, minus one squared, minus one.
Was it one? Okay.
Yes. I was just giving an example of something which vanishes. So in general, if I have a1 to the n, a minus 1 to the n, p, this will give me n factorial, p, p prime, and so on and so forth. If I have, I don't know, I mean, we can write the most general thing, but right, product of over I, ai to the ki, product over I, a minus I to the ki, p prime. You get something like product over I, ki factorial, I to the ki, p p prime. So I can readily compute the inner products. And it's just the usual harmonic oscillator thing. The only difference is that I put an n here instead of a 1 for reasons of convenience. Again, purely convention.
The Hilbert space structure again.
Yes.
Is it, can we think of it as naturally being divided into subspaces, each of them being generated by P and the creation of Nilesian operators, or is that?
You can. It's they are not exactly subspaces because these are not delta function normalizable. Because these are delta function normalizable, they're not, no, so it's not really a direct sum, more like a direct integral over P. So you have a continuous collection of Fock spaces. The cleanest way to think about it is just literally this tensor product. I have a Fock space and I tensor it with a zero mode Hilbert space, which means a vector in here is pretty much a pair of a vector in here and a vector in here. So whenever I write this P, if you want, I could have written P tensor 0. Whenever I write something like that, I could have written P tensor minus 1, 0. This is perhaps what you want to see. That's perfectly fine. OK. It finishes at 11:15, or? Okay. You have any questions?
Of the states, that the way that we wrote them here,
yes,
like all of the three states that are like two annihilation, like, do they have the same energy?
Right, so we can anticipate this fact. So An creates, sorry, A minus N creates energy N and momentum N. And A minus A bar minus N creates energy N and momentum minus n. So these are left and right moving particles on this worksheet. So this scalar, you can think about this scalar field describes fluctuations of the worksheet. These ones are, these operators create waves on the worksheet, waves on your string, waves that move right and waves that move left. And these waves have this energy and this momentum.
Is P, so P is not the center, is it the center of mass, momentum, or?
No, sorry, this is a capital P. Sorry.
So the excitations live on some center of mass momentum state, and then
yes,
themselves can have some permanent momentum.
I'm sorry, there's a true momentum here has to be used in a overloaded fashion. There's momentum in space-time and the momentum on the string. And they're different things. They have nothing to do with each other. Or something to do with each other, but in a not in a Gaussian invariant way. Anyway, so here I'm talking about the momentum on the string defined as the integral of t0 of t12 of t, t, let me call it sigma t sigma tau, the sigma from 0 to 2 pi l. I'll introduce it next time. And the energy is the integral from 0 to 2 pi l of t tau tau, the sigma.
And we're labeling the zero mode Hilbert space by the momentum of the string in spacetime.
Yes, yes. This state happens to have energy, which is d squared over 2, just because there is an x dot squared. And momentum in spacetime, which is actually 0. Sorry, momentum in the worksheet, which is 0.
So here the quantities you've written as integrals are on the string itself.
Yes, like that's right.
Energy, versus here the energy is the center of mass energy, and then here you're...
No, these are still the same E and big E and big P, sorry.
That's also on the string.
Yes, so I'm saying this state has some energy momentum computed like this. Next time I'll introduce the stress tensor so I can do the calculation. And this energy momentum on the worksheet are p squared over 2 and 0.
So associated to the center of mass momentum, is there an energy that's like an eigenvalue of some operator here? Or is this energy we can...
So here I'm looking at one coordinate in space-time. There are 26 coordinates. Each of them has their own p. This is just the... So if you're looking at x0, this is called energy in space-time. If you're looking at x1, x2, x3, you call the momentum in space-time. But, it's just the energy momentum vector. And by the way, I can anticipate something super quick. That notice that, right, as we were saying, we need to impose the constraint that the stress tensor vanishes. So actually, here we're studying the Hilbert space of the scalar field theory. The Hilbert space of the string theory has to have this extra constraint that the stress tensor vanishes. Naively, they would force you to have p squared equal to 0. So all your strings move the speed of light in the, this string stays would move the speed of light in space-time. There is a correction to that. But anyway, the reason we're computing this energy momentum is to figure out what is the spectrum of the string theory inside the spectrum of the scalar field theory.
So because we don't have an action, we don't really have a space-time action. What we have is a Wolfschmidt action, right?
Yes.
So we don't really know what the dynamics of the string itself is in space-time, just purely by looking.
We can do quantum field theory, for example, talking about particles, never ever mentioning a field. We have particles, they move around, and their interactions you create and destroy particles. So even for particles, you wouldn't need to have an action as a function of fields. You could be perfectly happy having just the word line action and the interaction vertices. String theory is even nicer because you don't even need the interaction vertices because the strings can smoothly split or join. And so you can describe everything using the string theory, the worksheet action in perturbation theory in space-time. So you're still doing Feynman diagrams or the analog of Feynman diagrams. So whatever we're going to do will define only perturbative string theory. So string theory is a perturbation theory around some free string theory.
Then on these nodes, like A minus 1P and A bar minus 1P, they have the same energy but different momentum?
On the worksheet, that's right, yes.
And these three, the same?
Yes, okay. That's right. So this one, well, yeah, these three have the same energy, but these have momentum 2, this is momentum 0.
Then the quantum number P becomes the quantum of energy for each string?
Which p? The little p?
Yes.
So the little p is just the zero mode momentum.
Momentum of
x dot. It's just x dot. Okay, it's a. It's. I mean, if you were to replace the string by a particle, you would just kill all of the Fourier modes. The center of mass of the string is a particle. Okay? And so this is just the possible states of a particle in space-time. And yes. And when you quantize a massless particle in space-time, for example, right, you would then impose the constraint that p squared is zero. The Hilbert space of a free particle, free massless particle in space-time, has states labeled by a p with p squared equal to zero.
So these terms you're adding, do they literally correspond to like energy oscillations of the string itself?
Yes. Yes. That's right. So a string, as any extended object would, behaves at low energy like a collection of particles, or like a particle with internal states, like a nucleus. A nucleus can be in its ground state or in some excited state. The energy of a nucleus moving about will be the momentum of the nucleus plus whatever comes from the internal excitations.
One question related with what David asked, like in quantum field theory, we like learned many times why it is important. Like when we were motivating that we need quantum field theories, we motivated that we need fields.
Yes.
So my question is, does it make sense to ask for a string field theory or something?
You can. So you can write down an action which reproduces the string theory scattering amplitudes. It's actually a necessary step to do certain calculations, as was recently stressed by Sen. But it does not, we don't know how to use it to get a non-perturbative definition, meaning we don't know how to do a path integral with that action. So it's action with infinitely many fields and infinitely many non-local interactions. So it's not clear that it gives a non-perturbative insight. So string field theory is definitely a thing. But conversely, I will stress that in perturbation theory, strings are fields are a convenient device. They're not an intrinsic need. You could, in principle, do everything in the first quantization formalism. It would just be a pain. Yes.
Earlier, you said that unitary T only makes sense in Lorentzian signatures.
Mm-hmm.
What did you mean by
that? Well, the notion of unitarity. You cannot formulate it in Euclidean signature. In Euclidean signature, you get something called reflection positivity at best, which implies unitarity for the Lorentz, for the weak rotator theory. Like, it's not a deep thing, okay? Just look at the Schrödinger equation. The Schrödinger equation, right, is, I del minus I del over del t equal to some Hamiltonian. Oof, minus plus. Sorry, I forget. Not like that. Anyway, well, this is a Hermitian operator, so it's a real number. So this gives you an evolution, which is e to the I h t h. Great. Suppose I go to Euclidean time. You get something like that. You get an evolution e to the minus tau h. not unitary. It's DRT. If you're